Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. There's a lot going on. In Israel, we're in the middle of the Passover holiday. Let me just say, happy Passover and Chag Sameach to our listeners. And Israel's gearing up for a large-scale offensive in the southern Gaza town of Rafah, as Hamas is upping its own pressure on Israel by releasing a video yesterday of someone who's probably the most well-known hostage of the 133 being held in the Gaza Strip, 23-year-old Israeli-American Hirsch Goldberg Poland, seen wounded in that video, missing half of his left arm, which was wounded during the October 7th attack when he was taken to Gaza. His mother, Rachel, has really been one icon and one of the symbols of the fight to get back the Israeli citizens and others who are being held against their will in Gaza, and was recently on the Time 100 list. We have to keep praying and doing what we can to get the hostages back as soon as possible. But with all of that that is going on, we're actually looking on today's episode across the Atlantic to the United States and trying to understand what in God's name is happening at Columbia University, where for anyone who's been following the news, you know there have been violent protests against Israel, calls to kill Jews and Israelis, and physical assaults of Jewish students. Tent encampments like the one at Columbia are now popping up on campuses across the United States as anti-Semitism surges at U.S. universities. I speak on today's episode with Yola Ashkenazi, a brave student at Barnard College of Columbia University, who's been all over the news, who's been speaking at rallies and speaking on cable television and at events, and outspoken about the anti-Semitism, the anti-Israel protests, and what needs to be done, and what it's like today to be a Jewish pro-Israel student at an Ivy League school. I then check in with two of my JPPI colleagues who have had long careers teaching at U.S. college campuses, Gil Troy and Sarah Hirshhorn, to get their thoughts on what's happening, and just as important, what needs to be done to change things. Here we go. Yola, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So we're catching you on a break here in Israel, and I'm glad you're able to get this break and not have to be on campus with all the craziness that's going on there. But already before what we've been seeing over the last few days, I mean, you've been a champion, really. I've watched several of your videos and interviews and testimonies and wow. I mean, you know, we just need a bunch more like you out there and the world would look different.
No. I'm just trying the very, very little bit that I can do in this tough time for all of us.
Okay, but describe for us, please, like, how bad is this situation? Because, you know, it's one thing for me here in Jerusalem to be watching all these videos flying across my Twitter feed. It's another thing to be a junior at, you know, Barnard Columbia and be going through everything that's going on there. Yeah. So walk us through what it's like.
Absolutely. So the situation over the past week has been drastically different than the situation over the past 6 months. So right after October 7th, we had this sort of eruption of small, isolated anti-Semitic incidents. So like two Israeli friends speaking Hebrew on the steps of Lowe Library, and someone comes up to them, hey, are you speaking Hebrew? They answer yes. The guy sits on the floor next to them. Isolated incident from an Israeli student who was hanging up kidnap posters on October 9th, and someone, a former student, hits him with a stick. I'm sure you might have seen that it was widely covered. So these smaller little incidents, but nothing in like a grand scheme. No big mobs of people chanting, kill the Jews. You know, there were, of course, a bunch of protests, and I felt like I never really felt personally at risk from them. So people could chant from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. I was scared for this Jewish state. I was scared for the American future, but I was never personally scared. And then that all changed in the past week when, after I testified in Congress at Congresswoman Fox and Stefanik's press conference, where the students just in mobs started chanting for deaths of individual students. which is just insane and not something that I thought we'd get to. And I've been doing a lot of thinking, how did we get to this point when it wasn't that violent before? The rhetoric was bad, but it wasn't violent. And the truth is, I don't know. I have a couple of ideas and we could chat about it.
So I'm curious about that. Before we get to what has led to this escalation, I mean, you were already testifying before Congress, before this spate of violence. You were out there in the media. You were at the rallies. I mean, I can understand that you didn't feel personally at risk, maybe, but it was a hostile environment. And despite that, you did feel a need to step up when a lot of people did not. So explain to me, if you can, what do you feel like? What motivated you to do that?
It was actually totally accidental in the beginning. On October 12th, it was the Thursday after the 7th, there was a really big pro-Palestinian rally on campus. And there was this reporter. It wasn't a huge, huge media group. It wasn't Fox. It wasn't CNN. Like, I didn't recognize the name. And I saw this reporter interviewing 10, 15, 20 of the pro-Palestinian students. And then when he came to our side, because of these smaller isolated incidents that happened in the span of those 4 or 5 days on campus, none of the Jewish students or pro-Israel students really felt like speaking to any media. It was a hard time. It was a very sad time. I almost like don't remember how sad it was. That's how, like, I feel like we're all just like, we've been in go, go, go mode. And like, I still haven't had time to fully digest that, but nobody would speak to this reporter. And so I saw the reporter walking away and I look around and I run up to this reporter. I'm like, hi, if no one will speak to you, I'll say something. Because just to myself, like, it was an instinctual thing that he just spoke to 15 of the pro-Palestinian students and not one Jewish or pro-Israel student would speak with him. And so I gave him just like a 30-second like soundbite of, I cannot believe I have people justifying murder and rape and they're my classmates and something along those lines. And I don't know where that video is, but a booker on Fox News saw it and reached out to me the next day. And I was kind of hesitant, but I thought to myself that I'm going to want to look back on these days and be able to say that I'm proud of the way that I reacted. And when one day, like, I'm God willing telling my children about this crazy time in my life and a horrible and sad time for the Jewish people, that I did something that I'm proud of. And that just motivated me to keep going.
Right.
And then once, you know, someone else called me to do another media interview, I was like, okay, I'll do it. And then when I saw that administration wasn't responding to my emails, but then they did respond when I called them out personally on national television, I was like, wow, this really does make a tangible difference in my community and in my campus. And if I don't keep on going, I don't know who will. And it's almost like I felt very much like I was put there for this reason. And, you know, it actually led to a whole bunch of different things that I think really like changed the course of my life and my career.
So let's talk about just specifically though, what's been going on campus and the change that, you know, so they started to respond, which is great, but the situation has not necessarily improved. And I'm curious, I mean, you see what's going on. If your younger sibling, your younger sister or brother or whoever, if you have a younger brother, but if they come to you and they say, Yola, should we go to Columbia? What would you say?
My brother will be coming to Columbia, not next year because he's taking a gap year in Israel, but the following year he'll be attending Columbia. And I actually think Columbia is an incredible institution. For my first year was COVID, but my sophomore, my junior years were really wonderful. And I've taken some really interesting classes and I've made some real bonds with a lot of professors. And the only reason why I'm doing this work is that so Jewish students can continue going to Columbia. If I just thought that, okay, it's a lost cause and no Jew should ever come to Columbia again, then what? There's no reason for me to be fighting. But I think that it's so important for us to be doing this work so that there is space for Jewish people at Columbia, so that Jewish students can feel comfortable and safe going to Columbia. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. If I thought that no Jewish students after me will ever be coming to Columbia, I wouldn't be spending my time making sure that the campus is better. But I genuinely believe that Columbia has the potential to be the great institution that I know it is. And so if I can improve it in a tiny way, I'm going to do that.
What's been your take on faculty? We've seen, you know, Professor Davidi, has really been very impressive watching him try to rally people and stand up for students. But it seems from afar, again, correct me, that most are quiet. Most are not taking to the streets, standing with you and other pro-Israel Jewish students. Have you been disappointed?
At first, I wasn't disappointed because I think the classroom should be a place where everyone feels like they can express their opinions freely. And if you know that your professor feels a certain way, you might not feel comfortable doing so. But then when I saw just how many faculty members came out in support of the pro-Palestinian students, and at this point, I'm calling them pro-Hamas students. There are students waving Hamas flags. There are signs saying that support our rockets. Like, at this point, I don't think there's much pro-Palestinian about them. I think it's more pro-Hamas at this point. But I've seen just how many professors have come out in support of them, have staged walkouts, have written letters upon letters. And it's just like, where is that same care and compassion for your Jewish students? And just last week, and I was in a class, it was on Zoom because I was already in Israel at that point. And the professor, we were just speaking about free speech. He's like, it was the day after NYPD came and made a bunch of arrests on campus in the Gaza encampment zone. And he was like, how's everyone feeling? Let's talk about free speech. Let's talk about what's making you scared on campus. A lot of people, the common like rhetoric was NYPD. It was frightening to see NYPD, and I totally understand that. It is frightening to see NYPD in riot gear arresting your peers, regardless of what the situation is. But I said, you know, I saw a student holding a Hamas flag, and that is frightening to me. Hamas holds, and their charter states that I should be dead, that I should be killed. And he said, yeah, and it's crazy that we live in this world in which different symbols mean different things to different people. And I'm sure that a Palestinian student, when they see an Israeli flag, might evoke the same pangs of fear for them. And I just was jaw dropped. I didn't know what to say. And as someone who always has something to say to a fault sometimes, I was just too stunned to speak. And I emailed my professor after saying, I don't think we can equate the Israeli flag with the Hamas flag. I have no fear over the Palestinian flag. I wasn't talking about the Palestinian flag. I was talking about the Hamas flag, a U.S. designated terror organization, like someone who's in their charter believes that I should be dead. Like, I quoted it for him. And he just responded, I'm so sorry you feel this way. Anti-Semitism has no place on campus, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, how many times can you say anti-Semitism has no place on campus, but then equate the Israeli flag to the Hamas? Like, it doesn't work. So I've been quite disappointed by faculty. And I think like my mind changes about this even on a daily basis when I interact with different faculty in different ways. Just like, keep your opinions to yourself. Then it's like, no, but I want you to like stand up for me. But I also, you know, so I think I oscillate between these feelings, but I have been overall largely disappointed by the faculty at Columbia.
So let's go back to what you were saying before of what you think led to this escalation. And what is it then? You said that you think there's a few things behind it.
I think there are a number of things. One, I don't think the university took a strong enough stance on October 8th. It took, I think, almost a week for the university presidents to condemn Hamas in really strong terms, as they should have. Mm-hmm. SJP wrote a letter calling Hamas's massacre justified resistance, and the university didn't comment on it. Just after the pro-Palestinian protests on October 12th, the huge one, like this was before Israel had started doing anything in Gaza, like this very beginning, the university didn't condemn that. So I think a large part of it is the university not being strong enough early on in October and November, and sort of letting the student body know that they are going to just use free speech as this really big, like, overarching, like, ultimate right. The ultimate right and, like, the ultimate good and not drawing a line. Like, there was no line drawn, not on October 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. And not when it started to get a little bit more, the rhetoric get a little bit more scary and tread that line a little bit more. They never drew that line. And so by them not drawing the line really early on, I think that posed a big problem for us because it showed the student body that they can get away with almost anything. And that's what I think really makes them think that they could get away with almost anything. And they have for the most part until now when it's gone completely out of hand. Another thing is when they suspended SJP and JVP, Columbia is one of the first schools to do it. They did it because they were holding protests in places that they were not authorized to hold protests. So the way it works at Columbia is you need to reserve a specific space and then the university needs to accept it and then you can use that space. And so they were just protesting, even if the university did not allow them to reserve the space. I think you need to reserve it like a week in advance, maybe even more. And so they didn't say anything about the rhetoric they were using. So again, it's like using free speech as like, we're going to let everything go. We're not drawing a line anywhere. We're not taking any sort of stance. I think they were trying not to because they didn't want to have to take that stance. But now we see 6 months later, that's really affected the way this like totally out of hand situation that we've gotten to, this complete anarchy on campus. And it's because they didn't draw that line really early on. And one other thing is they started CUAD after SJP and JVP were suspended, Columbia University Apartheid Divest, which is just a commitment of, I think it's 50 to 80 student organizations, not political organizations, not related to the Middle East. Like I'm talking dance teams, choir groups, theater clubs, and they all sign on to this CUAD, Columbia University Apartheid Divest. They have a whole bunch of, we believe the university should X, Y, and Z. One is stop the Tel Aviv dual degree, Tel Aviv University, Columbia dual BA program, things like that. And so it just made it this like, everyone has to get involved sort of thing. You know, all of a sudden, if you were on a dance team, you were voting on whether or not to sign on to CUAD or not.
And these people don't even know anything about what's going on and what the conflict is about.
Exactly.
I mean, I've seen so many of these videos of people, they've been asked, what are you protesting for? And people saying they don't even really know.
Yeah.
You know, Yola, I want to let you go, but I want to ask you one last question. There are two last questions, actually. So you're now in Israel. What's safer? Where do you feel safer today?
I actually said this in an interview recently that I feel safer in Israel than I do at Columbia right now.
Israel, which is to some extent a war zone.
Someone tweeted actually today, shame on, they tagged me for saying that she feels safer in a war zone than in Columbia University. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. And it's like, actually, I don't think you've been a Jew on Columbia University's campus, nor have you been in Israel recently. Because the sentiment I feel is that if a student were to scream at me some sort of not nice thing or like assault me on Columbia's campus, I don't think many people would bat an eye, to be completely honest. But if someone were to scream at me or assault me in the street of Tel Aviv, I know that there would be 100 people standing up for me in that very moment. And that's very much what I feel like. And I feel, I genuinely do feel safer here than I do at Columbia. And it's sad to say because I've never felt that way before.
And my last question, you said before that this is changing your career trajectory, your plans. So sorry that I said junior before, what's next after you graduate this year?
So I was going to work in finance. I have an internship now in asset management and I realized that I need to be doing something more, I'm more passionate about, something that I feel like I'm creating tangible change, not something, I have a very unique skill set, I think. And it's like, while I do have that complete math brain, I also have this whole whole other thing that I got going for me. And I need to do something more meaningful. And so I'm going to work at a private foundation. They do a lot of really cool and important work in policy and politics. And I'm going to be an analyst there. And I'm really excited. I get to do two things that I love, which is advocacy work and a little bit of the finance piece.
Okay. Well, Yola Ashkenazi, thank you very much for being with us. And thank you for what you've been doing at Columbia. Really inspiration.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Love getting to chat with you.
Thank you.
So, Gil and Sarah, it's great to have both of you, because like, when I'm thinking about who among our JPPI fellows really has insight into what's going on college campuses, I think it's probably the two of you. Gil, you were a long-time veteran tenured professor at McGill. You taught also at Harvard in the beginning of your career and guest lectured all over the place. Sarah, you've taught for many years at Northwestern. You're currently now on sabbatical here teaching at Haifa University and with us at JPPI. But both of you have spent a lot of time on college campuses. So let me start with you for a second, Gil. What the hell is going on at Columbia? And what needs to be done from your perspective in stopping what seems to me, and again, who am I, but seems to me to be a jihadi terrorist organization that has formed in, you know, uptown, you know, west side New York?
Look, it's heartbreaking. I always call myself a case of arrested development. I got to the university and never left. I love the university, but I love a university where students are allowed to go to class without being blocked by hoodlums. I love a university where students, even if they're Jewish, can go to class without being called Yehudi and F the Jews and also attacked. I love a university where professors understand that even if they disagree with Israel, they should be reaching out. In fact, the pro-Palestinian ones should be particularly reaching out to students and saying, I'm with you. So what can be done? Let me give three different things. One is, when I was at McGill as a young professor, it was in the middle of finals week, and I went to the library, and I happened to walk into the bathroom, and it was disgusting. And I went straight to the director of the library system, and I said, I'm a professor. I don't take just responsibility for my students. I take responsibility for all students. And we can't have a situation where the bathrooms are disgusting because the students deserve some respect. So I think more and more professors have to start acting not as political activists, not as communist propagandists, but as educators, taking responsibility for every single student on campus. And I really believe, given how connected I was to McGill University in my day at Harvard, if there had been pro-Palestinian students who felt harassed, I would have been the first one to hug them, to hold them, to escort them. So I think the professorial culture has to change. That's number one. Number two, I think the presidents of the universities have to get control of the campus. And that means that there should be a very clear rule that if you block anyone going to the normal functioning of a campus, be to class or to coffee or whatever, you are immediately not only suspended, but you lose your tuition for that year. That basically you lose the year. And let these student goons start going home to mom and dad saying, oh, we need another $86,400 to spend another year at Columbia. I also think that we need to start getting tort lawyers to go to the Jewish students who have been assaulted. And if the police aren't going to do it, and if the administrators aren't going to do it, they should start filing personal suits. So again, these lovely students come home to mom and dad and say, mom and dad, we've got a problem. I've got some aggressive lawyer who's suing me and you personally for assault and for harassment. And even if the suits don't succeed, they will have a chilling effect on this behavior because the universities will have shown there are clear red lines. And the third piece is, there has to be a fight, again, by professors and by administrators and by parents as a consumer issue, against what I call educational malpractice. The classrooms cannot be political communist re-education camps. They must be places where left and right, religious, non-religious, atheists, all kinds of people learn together and learn from one another, even if they dare disagree. So there are things that can be done while respecting free speech, while respecting the quality of student life, and most important, taking every single student's educational experience, whether they pay the full $86,400 or get a freebie, taking it personally, as professors, as administrators, and as parents?
So, I mean, you know, very interesting. There's so much, so many different aspects to this whole story also. You know, Columbia now being kind of the pinnacle of it, because although it's happening on other schools across the U.S., NYU now has an encampment that's been set up by the Stern Building, and Sarah, you were talking about Tufts and all others, these tents that people are popping up. But like at Columbia, you're seeing people... I love the get up with the, you know, the keffiyeh and the COVID mask. It's like, you know, that's the new disguise if you want to be a jihadist in the United States today. But also the type of slogans that are being chanted there. It's hard to know who's a student on campus, who's just somebody who's, you know, hitching a ride on the back of what's happening at Columbia. But, you know, well, I watched a video just the other day of calling for intifada, calling for martyrdom. There's that picture of a Jewish family from the east side that went up to Columbia and was waving Israeli and American flags. And a blonde girl with a keffiyeh stands there and says, El Qassam, here are your next targets. I mean, like, it's insane that this is happening in New York. And Sarah, I actually want to ask you, though, about... So there's this guy, Shai Davidi, who's really this Israeli professor who's teaching there, who's, I think, an associate professor, whatever it might be. And he's teaching at Columbia, and he's really been outspoken and a real knight in shining armor, I would say, for the Jewish students. But what I've been wondering is, and maybe you could shine some light on this, because I've never really pursued a higher degree at one of these colleges, or let alone been an associate professor or a full tenured professor. But how come we don't see more Jewish, and Gil kind of touched on this, more Jewish professors who are speaking out and speaking up loudly and saying this is unacceptable? And let me just add to the to that element, you know, because I'm sure many of our listeners know this, but if you're a tenured professor, they can't fire you. Right. So why are they not? Why are the tenured professors not speaking up? You know, let alone the associates or the untenured, they could actually lose their jobs. Maybe that I can understand. But I have friends who are tenured professors at some of these Ivy League schools, and you don't hear a word from them. A word. Jewish pro-Israel people. Why is that?
Okay, I'm going to get myself into some trouble here, but I have to say, I'm really deeply ashamed and aggrieved by the behavior of some of my colleagues. I've been an untenured professor, junior professor, and I think at a certain point, you understand that this transcends certain, you know, aspirations of careerism or your comfort in a department of people who have an inability to have a healthy discourse around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or really a lot of other issues, because the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I think, is really only a canary in the coal mine of a lot of larger issues that are happening on campus. And at some point, you have to, you know, step up or step out, because you are becoming part of the problem on campus. And I was watching a video of, you know, anti-Zionist professors at NYU forming a human chain around the tent encampment to prevent the police from arresting these students. I'd like to know where my colleagues are in Jewish and Israel studies departments across the country forming a human chain around Jewish and Zionist students who are there to protest peacefully and are receiving both verbal and physical abuse from their classmates and possibly off-campus agitators who are coming to their protest. I think it's incumbent upon the professoriate to start taking an active role here, if not for the sake of Zion, just for the sake of being against rampant Jew hatred on campus, for the sake of standing up for students who also need protection. In fact, now need protection from their own peers. And I really, for the life of me, cannot understand where my colleagues are. And if they're hiding under their desks, it's time to, you know, hit the streets. And I know this is going to come, frankly, at a cost saying this myself, but I feel like we are in this moment now where it needs to be said.
And I understand the dilemma that some of these professors have, right? Gil, they are worried that if they don't speak up, if they speak up, they could be dismissed or they could lose their job or they won't be part of that, the cool kid clique anymore, right? I don't know if that's how it works with professors.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, is this not a moment in time for people, as Sarah said? This is what else is this about, if not now?
Absolutely. First of all, I want to honor Sarah because Sarah has been very, very courageous. And it's easy when you have tenure, and it's much harder when you don't have tenure. And by the way, the same thing, Shaul Davidi is an assistant professor without tenure, and his status at Columbia is being questioned. So those younger colleagues who have stood up, and unfortunately there aren't enough of them, but those younger colleagues really, really deserve a medal. And my sense is that I probably don't agree with Sarah or with Shaul on many issues politically, but we believe fundamentally, ideologically, in the importance of university, which is, to use that popular word, a safe space, and also a place where we can learn from one another, even if we dare disagree a little bit politically. So that's number one. Number two is the mask is the tell. The fact that they are mask protesters shows that they still are those same achievement, career-oriented machines that got into Columbia. And it shows their weakness. And if only people had the courage to stand up to them. And I agree with you, Sarah, that we have to hear it from Jewish studies professors, but I also want to hear it from my American history colleagues. And instead, I want to hear it also from people who are critical of Israel, who say, no, this is an important issue. And don't fall into the old, oh, look how wonderful they were in the Vietnam War. During the Vietnam War fight of the 1960s, when there also were student excesses, it wasn't student against student. The notion that today students are being singled out for daring to be pro-Israel, and frankly, for daring to be Jewish, daring to be, now this ugly word, visibly Jewish, because they wear a kippah, or they might have a beard, or they might, you know, they might dress differently, and singled out, that brings university politics to a whole other level. That's not about free speech. That's about just a target practice on one particular group. And after all these years of learning about microaggressions and safe space and all that, to see the degree to which Jews are blocked at the intersection and macroaggressions are accepted against them, against us, is truly reprehensible. And I do think I call this the silence of the tenured lambs, because you're right. Assistant professors have their issues, but you've got tenure. What more do you want from life? And if more people don't stand up, and by the way, we should point out that there is a letter circulating with over 3,000 Columbia professors and particularly alumni. So there is a pushback from the Columbia community, but it also doesn't get the press that the 54 law professors who attacked the president get, that the 1,400 academics from across the world who are now calling to boycott Columbia because those poor students were peacefully protesting, I'm quoting exactly, get. So there is a bit of a pushback, but the pushback is often far too polite, far too quiet, far too behind the scenes. And I keep on calling, I've been saying this again and again since October 7th, grow a spine. It's exactly what Sarah said. This is a
moment. But I also wonder if there's anyone left to grow a spine, because it seems like there's been a pretty systematic Stalinist purge in the academy of people with dissenting viewpoints, not only about Israel, but on a lot of issues. I mean, you just need to look at survey after survey that tells you that, you know, 4% of college professors identify as conservative. Most identify not even as liberals, but on the left. So I don't know who's left. There's been, I think this exposes a huge mechanism of gatekeeping. And the whole apparatus that has blocked career advancement of those with dissenting views, blocked the publication of scholarship, certain forms of pedagogy. It's been, you know, this has been entrenched, and it's also a series of discourses that have now become so institutionalized within the academy that any other viewpoint is really unacceptable. So I even wonder who's left to be able to you know, grow a spine these days, because there's been such an effort to ensure that the university has no place for them.
I wonder, Sarah, you know, I mean, like looking at Columbia, one of the big questions now on other campuses also is what could they have done differently, right? Because there is the right to protest. There's the right for freedom of speech. Should they have the right to set up this tent camp? Should they not? You know, okay, once they've set up the tent camp, though, can they assault Jewish students who they see, and you watch these videos of them saying Zionists are among us, we have Zionist intruders, things along those lines, blocking Jewish alumni and Jewish professors and Jewish students from coming into college onto the campus? I mean, like, it should have been dealt with much quicker, swifter, with a stronger repercussions or response by the schools. But the schools are also, they're scared and weak. I mean, I think that's what we've seen all along here. No?
Right. Look, first of all, I think we should say that some of the questions facing university leadership are only Israel-Palestine adjacent. A lot of them are about generational change that the university has yet to come up with any kind of policy to address. The rampant and pervasive use of social media by students and also by activists off campus who want to influence what's happening in campus politics. The nature of consequences for millennials who really never seen that happen in their lifetime and suddenly are being asked to suffer certain consequences for their activism around this particular issue and are saying, oh, it's about Israel-Palestine. No, it's about consequences for actions, full stop. And I think that's something that a whole generation of students and frankly, the professoriate and administrators is, you know, really late to get onto. And the last thing, I guess, is about the changing nature of free speech. It's one thing to call for free speech absolutism, which has been sort of a university held cherished ideal. But let's be honest, today we're in a situation where there are, you know, big thumbs on the scale of free speech. And when we're talking about free speech is not really free for all groups equally. And we need to address that kind of environment and how to, I guess, encourage free speech and to ensure that the university is a place where the diversity of viewpoints could be held. And certainly actually that the ideal of academia should be where diversity of viewpoints is argued and interrogated and criticized. While still understanding that, you know, free speech isn't really free today and, you know, DEI and woke discourses and, you know, the institutionalization of a set of principles about how we should look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, hashtag this and hashtag that has, you know, put a finger on the scale of free speech around these issues that is very difficult to undo at this point. I'd also like to say that I think we also have to look at the nature of tenure. Tenure is meant to be a job for life. But if you're saying things that are, you know, in support of a U.S., you know, recognized terrorist organization, is that free speech or is that, you know, morphed into something a little bit different? Is that, you know, verbal or material support perhaps for terrorism? And, you know, that's something that I think has gone beyond the nature of free speech and has gone further into the, you know, throwing a bomb in the theater.
And I'll just say, you know, obviously there's also people waving Hezbollah flags, around these college campuses. But I think, you know, as you're talking about what is the definition of free speech is also, and you kind of said this, if it wasn't Jews that they were protesting against, if it wasn't Israel that they were protesting against, and other people have made this argument, if it was, you know, African-Americans that they were protesting against while using curse words that we won't mention here and other signs, would that be something that they would tolerate to the same level that they're tolerating the calls for genocide in Israel and assaulting Jewish kids? So I think we all kind of know the answer to that question. And that's why this is so not just distasteful, but so hurtful, because it's obvious that this is something that when it's Jews and when it's Israel, it's okay. On that note, I want to thank both Sarah and Gil. Thank you very much for being with us. To everyone else, we will be taking off again on Monday because of the Pesach Passover holiday. You could catch us next Thursday. That will be our next episode. So in the meantime, continue to have an enjoyable Passover to those who are celebrating. Have a Shabbat Shalom this coming weekend. Enjoy the weekend and enjoy the last day or days, depending where you are, of the Passover holiday. And we'll be back with you next Thursday. Thank you very much.